From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made at a school food drive in Oregon. A third grader named Orion went home and asked his parents for some heavy food to bring to school. Because if the class collected the most pounds of food or collected the most money, they would win a pizza party. While Orion's dad was shopping for cans of beans at the grocery store, he couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong with that food drive. He realized that it was a microcosm for what's wrong with America's emergency food system. Food banks and food pantries measuring their success in terms of pounds and people. The more food available and the more people served, the more successful those banks consider themselves to be. But really, he thought, those are signs of failure. They don't measure outcomes or impact, and they don't address the systemic issues that cause hunger in our country. After the food drive, Orion's class walked away with a pizza party, and Orion's dad walked away with a mission to understand and solve the underlying problems of which hunger is a symptom. Problems like racism, poverty, and poor education. In his research, he came to learn that food banks are tied to big business, and they don't address those structural issues. In fact, he writes, they exacerbate them. He learned that while charity has risen, chronic hunger and food insecurity have not diminished. Orion's dad is Andy Fisher, a nationally renowned expert in food security. He co-founded and led the Community Food Security Coalition, and he's the author of a new book called Big Hunger. That book provides a vision for how to untangle corporate interests from the anti-hunger movement. And he's in Rochester today talking about that vision. And he's my guest on Connections This Hour for a conversation about how we can solve America's hunger problem. Andy, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Also joining me in studio are Daniel Bernhard and George Carruthers of the Toronto-based think tank Mushroom Cloud. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about Mushroom Cloud and your work on food systems.
So Mushroom Cloud is a consulting and technology company that works to advance the public good. We work with charities and foundations and government agencies to find creative ways to solve really difficult social problems like hunger, like food insecurity. And as the name suggests, we are very open to controversial ideas that sometimes upset the status quo. And we have been, for the past couple of years now, working on ways for food banks to get in and start to address core aspects of hunger by starting to use the assets that exist in impoverished communities, not just try and fill in the gap, but actually to try and harness those assets, because there's a lot of money, which is counterintuitive to some people, but there are a lot of money in those communities. And instead of letting those just go to some of the biggest, greediest retailers, we think that there may be some better uses for them, and that community organizations play an important role there. So we've been working on retail approaches to food insecurity, and looking forward to discussing them with you over the hour.
Absolutely. Also back in studio, Mitch Gruber, the Chief Program Officer for FoodLink and a member of Rochester City Council. Welcome back to you, Mitch.
Always a pleasure to be here.
And I know everyone is here today because there's an event coming up at FoodLink. Tell us what's happening today, Mitch.
Yeah, the event is actually at Three Heads Brewery. It's tonight from 4 to 6. We're going to have a panel similar to the one that you're hearing today, but we'll obviously have a lot of interaction with audience and a chance for Andy to also be able to sell and sign some books. And really for folks to hear about what is happening in the local community, because I'm very proud to say that Andy highlighted FoodLink as one of the more kind of innovative and progressive food banks in the country, and I think we have a lot of important things to share.
Absolutely. Listeners, if you'd like to join this conversation or ask your questions about hunger and food insecurity in America, you can call the program at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@wxxi.org, or you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. So I'd like to start with a broad question for all of you, one that's raised in Andy's book. And it's about the definition of hunger, because Andy, you write that the meaning of hunger has become somewhat murky, and different perceptions or definitions cause us to react to it or perceive it in different ways.
Right. Hunger is a very challenging term to use in the United States, because for many people, it draws connotations, it draws images of children starving in Africa, you know, with swollen bellies and the like. And we don't have that level of starvation, thankfully, in the United States. What we do have is ongoing deprivation and ongoing changes in people's diets due to lack of income. So people may be substituting high carbohydrate, starchy foods that aren't so nutritious that lead toward obesity or lead toward diabetes while they're being hungry. So while they're also food insecure. So there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of behavior change around food, what the British call food poverty. But it's not, people don't see it as hunger, so it gets confusing for the public.
So if you, is it, can we put a definition on hunger in this country? What, if you were to do that succinctly, what would you say?
Hunger is a societal phenomenon. It's a biomedical condition. It's involuntary, and it's linked to a lack of resources with which to purchase food.
Mm-hmm. I see everyone nodding around the studio. Mitch, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a challenging question, and we actually had a staff meeting at FoodLink just recently to kind of talk about Andy's book and to dive into it. And we had a lot of different opinions around the table, and I think what that proves is that there really is not a standardized definition, at least of what anti-hunger organizations are supposed to be doing, or really what places like FoodLink are supposed to be working on when it comes to trying to define things like hunger or food insecurity. I would say that ultimately, circling back to what the cause is of all this, which is poverty, which is a lack of economic power to be able to buy whatever food you want when you need it, that to me starts to drive in a little bit deeper as to what the real problem is.
And this is by far the most important point of the discussion, and I'm happy that it's come to this so quickly, but it's also one of the things that makes FoodLink such a leader in this field. People have one income and they have a whole bunch of expenses, housing, electricity, transportation, food. And if their income is insufficient to cover those expenses, they have to cut somewhere. And food is often the first thing to go. But that is not a food issue. It's a money issue. We have more than enough food. We throw away food. We put corn-based ethanol in our gas. We feed corn and soy to cows that later become our food. There is so much food. There's never been more food. The issue really is money. And so these institutions like FoodLink, but also books like Andy's that are starting to draw attention to the connections between these things, really do help us get to the center of it, of what hunger means in such a prosperous place.
And I think what Andy does in an effective way through his book is articulates just how emotive a word like hunger can be. Janet Papendick, in some of her writing, another authoritative voice on this issue, has talked about hunger as being a concept and an idea and a word that is very useful to a variety of people and a variety of interest groups. So I think you can see that food and hunger, by extension, is actually a wonderful rallying point, center around to bring ideas and resources together and to start to talk about some of these more systemic issues, some of the causes of hunger, some of the solutions that can be found around it.
And I was just going to add that I think I like to see us move away from hunger as a nation, and not just move away from it in the sense of no one should be hungry, but move away from it as a focus of a social problem. I like, because for the United States for 2018, when we think of hunger, people think of the solution being food. And as my colleagues have just said, that's not the case. The case is really a lack of economic resources and, frankly, a lack of political power. So it's time for us to be thinking about other strategies and other issues and define the problem in different ways that enable more systemic solutions and more structural solutions than a Band-Aid.
When we talk about the emotion surrounding hunger, like you mentioned, George, I think that there's also emotion surrounding the words food bank and food pantries, because many people probably hear those words and see them in a positive light. They think, oh, great, people are volunteering, they're helping feed people who need extra help. That's wonderful. But Andy, your work is critical of these emergency food systems. You describe the result of them as toxic charity. Tell us why you think that.
We've been doing food banking. Food banks really began in earnest in the early 1980s in response to a social emergency that came about because of a deep recession, because of high unemployment, and because of cutbacks from the Reagan era in the food stamp program. We've been doing that effort for 35 to 40 years, and it really hasn't been working as a solution to addressing hunger or food insecurity. So what happens over that time period when we keep doing the same strategies, we create a sense of a lack of movement. We create a sense that really nothing's changing. People become used to being reliant on charity. And charity is not a dignified way of feeding oneself. So it makes people more as objects of their destiny rather than subjects of their destiny.
Mm-hmm. And I would just add, you know, there's something to be said about names, right? And there's a lot of issues with nomenclature. What do we mean by these different things? But I want to point out that FoodLink is actually fairly unique in the way we label ourselves and what we call ourselves. Our colleagues to the west, it's the Food Bank of Western New York. Our colleagues to the east, the Food Bank of Central New York. I could go on and on. We've called ourselves FoodLink and kind of kept Food Bank out of the title, in part because we've always recognized that our job is to do more than just distribute emergency food. And the reason why we are where we are now is because our founder, Tom Ferraro, always learned from people like Andy and went to Community Food Security Coalition meetings, like The Stop in Toronto and Nick Saul and folks like that. There's a lot of folks out there who have been making sure this movement doesn't remain stagnant. And unfortunately, as Andy's book points out, there's quite a few food banks around the country that have remained stagnant. And I'm very proud, and I hope Rochester is very proud of the work that FoodLink is able to do to continue to drive and find new ways to harness and channel economic power and job creation and economic development into what we do as a food bank as well.
We'll talk about some of those examples of innovative approaches, including The Stop in Toronto and what's going on at FoodLink, some examples that Andy highlights in his book. But let's take a look at where food banks are today. So the first food insecurity survey by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, taken in 1995, showed that 12% of households faced low food security. Fast forward to 2018, that percentage remains the same, as Andy mentioned. So despite an increase in charity, we're looking at the same percentage of food insecurity among households. So 200 food banks in the Feeding America network, correct, Andy?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. 61,000 soup kitchens and food pantries serving 46 million people. That's $5 billion worth of food distributed. And there are only a few examples among those 200 food banks, Andy, that you think are using innovative approaches like FoodLink.
You know, yes and no. I mean, you're absolutely right in your statistics. There are only a handful or two of food banks around the country that are going upstream and advocating for higher minimum wages and addressing other kind of anti-poverty issues, that are addressing fundamental issues, as my colleague said, about the other parts of that they're spending money on, affordable housing, universal health care, or even protecting Obamacare, child care, all those issues that drive whether people are in poverty in the first place. Food banks have tended to stay in a very neutral political position. Maybe they're advocating around food stamps, maybe they're not. But generally, they're staying in this kind of what I call a nutrition safety zone. Apart from that, there is a great move among food banks around the country to be focused on health, to be focused on community development and generating jobs, as FoodLink does. So there's a growing groundswell of groups that are becoming much more progressive and moving in a very positive direction beyond moving food. But health seems to be much easier for them, and economic justice issues, because of the political controversy, the controversial nature of it, is much more challenging for them to move in that direction.
Yeah, I think your statistics really hammer home the point here, which is, you know, the charity is increasing, but food insecurity is flat. And the same is true in Canada. The first food insecurity study in Canada was in the 80s, and the number has been flat. The economy has grown, charity has grown, still flat. Because food assistance gives you food now, but what a food bank does is give you a small amount of food to get through a really tight spot. But there are a whole bunch of problems around the dependency on donated food, where that food comes from, what the food is, dependency in large part on volunteer labor. So, for example, in Canada, only 8% of food banks are open on the weekend. Fewer than 15% of food banks are open more than 15 hours per week. And when you consider that more than three quarters of the people on welfare have at least one job, who live below the poverty line, have at least one job, many have two, you do the math, when are you going to go? So in Canada, at least, and I imagine that the figures are similar here in the United States, about 22% of people who qualify for food assistance even go to claim it. So we're talking about a system that can't provide enough food in the long term to stabilize its current customers. And there are four times more customers that should be using it that aren't. And that just highlights the fact that this is about helping people who can access it right now in a pinch, but it does not solve the problem. This is not about solving hunger. Food banks just solve one little bit. And if you want to solve hunger, you need to do what Foodlink is doing. You need to do what Andy's talking about. You need to say, okay, stabilizing the patient is one thing, but it's not the end of the story.
In the short term, I could see critics sort of pushing back on that and saying, are you biting the hands of people that are feeding the hungry? How, you know, we see the need for change in the broad spectrum, but what about now? Why should we attack food banks now?
Yeah,
how would you respond to those people, Mitch?
It's a fair question, and I'm glad you brought it up because I was about to jump in and give a story from last week where I took a couple new staff members over to go visit one of the hot meal programs, what people would call a soup kitchen, downtown, to eat lunch and just see how the service was. And it was a really great meal. I was sitting at a table with two folks who self-identified as homeless, and I was asking them about what do they think about the food resources in town. And the gentleman to my left was very, very explicit when he said, you would have to try really hard to not be well-fed in this community. I think it's something that we ought to be proud of, that this is not just the work of Foodlink, it's our whole series of partners and all the folks providing hot meals and food pantries around the community. We do a good job of feeding folks, and that's important. And we don't want to stop doing that. We want to make sure that continues to happen, but we also have to start to think about how to get people out of those emergency food lines. We want to shorten those lines. We want to make less meals important.
And I think this isn't necessarily about criticizing, you know, in many respects, the fantastic work that Foodlink and others are doing to provide much needed assistance at critical times of the month. I mean, what my colleague Daniel has just what he's just mentioned about the case in Canada. I mean, for every one person who is accessing these services, there are in certain cases three or four who aren't. Now, that's for a variety of reasons. In some cases, it is something as simple as opening hours. In other cases, it's things like the appropriateness of the food. If you have a health condition and you can't get access to the food that you have to have or you must have based on your own personal health, you know, how can you actually end up getting a fix from a food bank? In other cases, it'll be issues around the actual physical accessibility of the stores, where they are, of the food banks rather. Where are they located? Is there transportation there? Can you get access to transportation? There's a number of issues that kind of plague the current system, not necessarily for the people who are benefiting from them now, but for the people who aren't.
And it's both. You need to eat. You know, if you are hungry now, you don't want to wait around for a long-term solution, right? You're hungry now. It's immediate. It's your kids. And food banks have been trying as best as they can, and in many cases have been succeeding to feed the people who are able to get there. And this is not about criticizing people who are feeding the hungry. They're doing a great job, but that's just one little part of it. And there are these other parts that are much bigger. And we need to do both. And I think that's the point. It's not to say that food banks have failed on their own. It's just we need both.
So I certainly don't want to bite the hand of Foodlink because they do a fantastic job of both addressing hunger today and tomorrow. But, you know, what one hand gives, the other takes away. I mean, if you look at Walmart, I mean, it's the clearest example of a donor that has donated $2.6 billion worth of product, $250 million worth of cash between 2010 and 2015, that paid its workers $9 an hour, has moved that up to $11 an hour thanks to great organizing from some labor activists. But, you know, it is paying its workers subliving wages. It does not give them regular hours. It does not give them full time in many cases. It actively encourages them to go to food banks, to get onto food stamps so that they can make ends meet. It is in Ohio, 13.5% of Walmart employees are on SNAP. If you extrapolate that nationally, that's $618 million that we as taxpayers are subsidizing Walmart because they're not paying their workers enough to make a living. Then Walmart turns around, uses the earned media that it gets from those philanthropic donations. It uses it to leverage neutrality and support in getting into markets from which it's been closed, such as New York City and Boston and Seattle and Chicago. All the while it's the single largest redeemer of SNAP in the country. In 2014, it redeemed 18% of SNAP benefits, or $13 billion. So it is completely gaming the system. So I don't have a problem biting their hand.
And similar to that, Kraft's food sales, 1/6 of their sales came from SNAP benefits in 2012. So you're talking about this, what you call a hunger industrial complex.
Absolutely. And, you know, it is not just, you know, the connections between between corporations and nonprofit organizations, but it's also those connections between corporations and the 80 odd billion dollars of federal food programs we have in this country, whether it be SNAP, WIC, school lunches, of which corporations are the primary vendor. They're making bank off of those sales, and it's absolutely an essential part of their income. So I think the question, from my perspective, and I hope I'm not jumping the boat on your questioning, is really how do we change that system? How do we turn that 80 odd billion dollars that's going to Tyson and to Cargill and to Walmart to bad actors in the food system, to companies that are abusing their workers, that are exploiting the environment, that are not treating their animals or their labor well? How do we turn that around, that system, so that we can use that money to support food that has values, values in the broadest sense, rather than that's just a good value in the narrow sense.
Yeah, so, and so Megan, if you don't mind, to jump in and kind of set the table a little bit. So Feeding America is the national umbrella of food banks. And like Andy said, there's about 200 or so food banks around the country. Every food bank has their own specific service area. So first and foremost, my colleagues from Toronto use the term food bank in ways that are actually different from how we utilize it here in the States. So FoodLink is the only food bank that serves the 10 counties that we serve, and so on to our left and to our right, and everything like that. So I would say that a lot of what Andy's saying about Walmart, for example, is absolutely true. I mean, we can't deny statements like that, which is why we encourage someone like Andy to come in and speak to folks. And I'll plug it again, 4 to 6 tonight at Three Heads. Want people to come out and see and have this conversation. But I would say that one of the ways that we start to address the question that Andy asked, which is how we move past this, is by thinking more on the local level than on the national level. Because the relationship between Feeding America and Walmart at corporate levels is incredibly close and incredibly twisted and intertwined. And I think that's a lot of what Andy writes about successfully and effectively. When you look at what's happening in Rochester, our relationships are much more with local retailers, like Wegmans, for example, but also with local farmers. And I could list you dozens of local farmers that we're working with, local manufacturers. And I think that allows us to create more lasting relationships and to really be part of what I would consider community development in Rochester versus Feeding America, where everything tends to be a very transactional relationship and you get a lot of the kind of ugly stuff associated with it.
You know how the NASCAR drivers wear all the logos of their sponsors, you know, on their suits? Well, if you go into the Office of Food Banks of Canada, which is our Food Banks Feeding America equivalent, they have the logos on the wall, Walmart, Subway, Cargill. And I mean, and when you start to look at Feeding America, the same is true. Who's represented on their board? Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Walmart, Kroger, the dairy exporters, Conagra. These are all represented there. And in many ways, the food system, the emergency food system, which started off as a very grassroots response to really immediate tough problems and is now professionalized to try and do its best in extremely difficult circumstances. There are actors like FoodLink that are trying to, you know, deal with the immediate issue at the same time as combating the systemic issues. But on the other side, there are some large corporations that, like Andy said, are not only causing the poverty that leads to hunger, but they're also treating this as a huge trash can for food that they don't want to sell, that's often spoiled. I mean, there was one food bank that we spoke to as part of our research that threw out 1/4 of the food it received by volume. 1 million pounds. They had to throw it out. They issued tax receipts for it, and then they had to pay to pick it up, take it, see that it was spoiled, and pay the fees at the dump to throw this stuff away. So there are competing pressures in this system, and how to navigate those pressures and still stay afloat in the short term is a difficult challenge, and it's one that I think Foodlink is handling very well. It's part of the reason why it's an inspiration for other similar actors around the country.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Andy.
I just wanted to add in one more little data point. You mentioned my son Orion earlier.
Yes.
On. So Orion and I, who's now in ninth grade, who loves to be in front of a computer like all ninth graders do, we did a bunch of research over Labor Day weekend, and we looked at every food bank's website in the country, and we were able to get employment affiliation data for the board members of about 80% of those food banks, and we found that about one in five food bank board members across the country work for one of the 1,000 largest companies in this country, Fortune 1000 companies, or in the private sector, the equivalent. So there's a high degree of integration between corporations and food banks at the board level. And those board members are often the ones that are holding back food banks from enacting more progressive policies, things that we talked about before around minimum wage and housing and the like. I should also just note that of those 2,286 board members we were able to identify where they worked, only two worked for a labor union.
Hmm. And so when you talk about relationships, as Mitch mentioned and highlighted in your book, Andy, we need more people who can speak for themselves. We are the people that need the support, need the help. Why are they not on these boards? And is it too optimistic to think that this can change in the short term? Can we get these people on these boards?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'll tell you, one of the strategies we've taken at Foodlink is we have what we call an agency advisory council. So it's a subcommittee of our board, and it's folks who are doing the service on a daily basis, and they have their own committee, and then the chair of that committee reports to the board. And that's a strategy we've had to make sure that the voice of the end user and a voice of where the food goes from the food bank is always represented at the board level. And that's very important to us. That doesn't mean that we're exactly where we need to be yet. And I think that a lot of what we've been trying to do over the last couple of years at Foodlink is we've been in a lot of ways shifting our focus to be more direct service oriented in some ways, like our curbside market, for example, which I'm always on this show talking about, so I won't belabor the point. But we've really been trying to engage our customers, folks who are utilizing SNAP benefits and shopping with us on a regular basis. And I'd love to get to a point in the next couple of years where we could have a committee of those folks and perhaps some board representation as well.
I'm late for our only break of the hour, so we'll take our short break. I'm seeing the phone starting to ring with your questions, listeners, so we'll get to that as well. I have more questions for Andy about his vision for overhauling food systems, and then we'll talk more about what's happening at the local level, what's happening in Toronto with the concept of social purpose groceries. So a lot more connections coming up next. I'm Megan Mack. Thursday on The Next Connections, should we fear death? That question is at the heart of a new documentary about death from accomplished filmmaker Helen Whitney. It's called Into the Night, and it's coming to PBS and WXXI-TV this Monday night. University of Rochester astrophysicist Adam Frank is featured in that film, and he joins us to discuss his views on death. Talk to you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about how we can solve America's hunger problem. And my guests include Andy Fisher, the author of the book Big Hunger, Daniel Bernhardt and George Carruthers of the Toronto-based think tank Mushroom Cloud. They're studying the concept of social purpose grocery. And Mitch Gruber from Foodlink. And Mitch, I know you have an event coming up that you'd like to talk about that involves everyone here on our panel today.
Yeah, that's right. Tonight it's 4 to 6 at Three Heads, which is over right off Atlantic. Come have a beer, hear us have this conversation in some more depth, talk a little bit about the book that Andy wrote and the great article that the folks from Mushroom Cloud did, and then interact with us afterwards.
Great. That is, again, today from 4 to 6 at Three Heads Brewery. Starting to see your comments come in. Listeners, you can join the program by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Up first on the phones is Peter in Rochester. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm sorry I've forgotten your name, but thank you for taking my call. And hi to Mitch, and thank you for a great program. My name's Peter Peters, and I'm chair of REACH, a homeless shelter here in Rochester. And I want to say how much I applaud the issue of hunger being dealt with as an economic issue and a political issue, and would like to hear the panel talk more about the failure of public housing authorities to provide not just affordable rent housing, but housing that's affordable to very low-income people. Part of our problem is that our public policy program has set rents to be driven by market prices, even subsidized rents. And what we need is housing.
Okay, guess we lost Peter there, but I think we get the focus of his argument. I'll turn things over to Andy. Okay, yes, we lost Peter, but we're talking about affordable housing. Andy, what are your reactions to Peter's comments?
Affordable housing is the number one, or housing is the number one expense for most households. And the lack of affordable housing is one of the main reasons, is one of the main things we can do to reduce hunger. I'm not an expert in housing, and I pass it off to Mitch or my other colleagues if they have any specifics about what's going on here in Rochester.
Yeah, I mean, I saw you two look at each other, so I'll pass the torch to you two in a minute. But I'll address what Peter was getting at. We have a significant issue to deal with a pretty significant problem of homelessness in the Rochester community. And fortunately, there are organizations like Reach and House of Mercy and a lot of folks doing some excellent work. And the list goes on, I should add. But we do need to figure out how to make sure that people are not winding up in a homeless shelter and having no ability to get out. And again, I think all this, the way it relates to this conversation is what Daniel said at the beginning, which is that everybody has a significant amount of expenses in their lives. And unfortunately, food tends to be the first one to go, and housing tends to be the hardest one to afford. And so I think that just that makes the need for affordable housing options and for some real low rents out there an absolutely critical need. And it means that organizations like Foodlink need to be on the forefront of that type of work. And again, it's a place where we have not necessarily really thrived at this point, but I think the community will see in the next 5-10 years that we take a more active approach. And I'm sure Andy can talk about some food banks that have been very vocal about advocacy on affordable housing and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Andy, go ahead. Do you have any?
Sure. I was just going to reference Oregon Food Bank out in Portland that has been starting to do some work on affordable housing. Gentrification has been a huge problem out in Portland. Rents have soared dramatically, and it has been a number one cause of dislocation of individuals who have lived in a traditionally African American neighborhood inner north and northeast Portland and been forced out to the outlying suburbs because of those high rents. And it continues to be an ongoing problem. And the food bank is recognizing that very issue of we all have one wallet. So they're starting to move in that direction.
Daniel, go ahead. I know you wanted to jump in.
Sure. Just to further Mitch's point, which I guess was furthering something I said earlier, people have, you know, there's one person, and they have their income and they have their expenses, and if the income falls short, there's not much that they can do. They have to start making really difficult choices, heat or eat, you know, it's that kind of thing. And so from a policy perspective, which is I think what Peter was talking about, it's important for policymakers to consider this as one broad issue. What do people need? What do people have? And how can we work either on the income or the expense side, and preferably both, to make life livable for people, not just affordable, but livable? I think the housing file is an interesting one, though, because, and this is something we'll probably require a whole other episode, but one of the things that we're interested in is what can charities and community organizations do in addition to drawing attention to some of these things. How can they actually intervene? And housing is a fascinating issue because, you know, there are a lot of people who make a lot of money off of housing, land is valuable, et cetera. This is one of the areas where a nonprofit acting creatively and entrepreneurially can actually get in and intervene and become a landlord, and do so on an advantageous basis. They don't want to make a profit. They have other objectives, and they can start to influence the market around them in positive directions. And those are the types of out of the box solutions that we're interested in. And housing is actually, I think, the one where that's being utilized the most, simply because it's the safest financially.
I think, you know, there's a variety of issues around expenses and where those dollars end up going. I know this is, I think, from 2015, but at the time it was 34% of food insecure households in America. We're still having to choose between food or medicine. And, you know, health is something that I think the food food assistance sector has been effective in intervening in, and is it's a growing part of their work. Housing, obviously, is something that's altogether more complicated to make adjustments on a monthly basis. You can make adjustments for food, and maybe you could skip a prescription, but ending up out on the street or in dire circumstances is something that people want to altogether avoid. So the urgency around the issue of housing, and to the original question, Peter, I think we're kind of dodging or talking around the issue as opposed to addressing it. But you highlighted a wonderful point, and also the fact that you called in and raised the issue to where we started this conversation. Food and hunger, again, become a really interesting rallying point for these issues. And I think where we're going to end up taking this conversation, hopefully shortly, is you know, there is a lot of interesting work going around in the food assistance sector. Some ideas, which I think my colleague Daniel and I are going to talk about, really put the onus on charities to start thinking outside of the box in ways in which they can intervene in markets that they aren't currently involved in, and in ways that might, you know, be able to provide some of these more tangible solutions to people looking for the, you know, looking for those bits of help.
So let's move into the social purpose grocery, because that's an example of what you're talking about. Daniel and George, where would you like to start with that? Because let's start with a broad concept in case our listeners don't know what that is. I know Mitch has spoken about it a bit on this program before, but if there are people out there who it's a brand new concept, let's start with the basics.
So food is a big expense, and it is a part of the burden of the cost of living. And people are spending a lot of money on food, and that money, as Andy's, you know, very articulately mentioned, goes to some of the largest, wealthiest, and sometimes most unscrupulous corporations on planet Earth. So poverty is often misunderstood. Poverty does not mean you have zero money. It means you have not enough money. And what is often overlooked is the fact that poor people actually have quite a bit of money. They simply don't have enough. And so what charities often try to do, because it's the natural first thing to do, is just fill in the gap. And they go and they try and source, you know, in this case, food. How much food can we find, and can we throw that at the gap, right? And what we are saying is, okay, that's one way of doing it, but what if we started with the money that people already had? So I'll give you an example. So in Canada, food insecure people who are classified by the government as being food insecure, spend $6.6 billion on food every year. Now, they need more than that, right? They're short about $1.7 billion. But if you take the 6.5 versus the 1.7, the 6.5 is a lot bigger. And so what we're saying is, why do charities need to try to focus on solving the 1.7? Why can't they take the 6.6 and try and stretch it into the full amount? And so our social purpose grocery idea is basically saying, well, why should Walmart be the only one in the food business? Why can't other organizations that have a public interest in mind get involved in this market and start to turn food, take it from being a burden that makes your life harder, and you turn it into something that lightens the cost of living crisis a little bit and makes it a productive force in life.
Sure. So what does that look in a tangible way? You go into a store like this, and there are deep discounts, or food is sold at, was it 22% less than the average retail price?
So the idea is that these markets could be open to everybody, that the food would be priced at the normal market price of whatever a discounter would be. But people who had come for food assistance, for example, would be able to get cash discounts, like a gift certificate, basically, a gift card worth, you know, so here's your emergency food assistance for this week that you've come that you need now. And here's $20 a week for the next 6 weeks, for example. And you don't have to, you know, take whatever happens to be in the box, whether you like it or not, whether it's suitable for your health needs or your religious needs or your cultural needs. Just take the money. It's the same principle as SNAP. But instead of taking the SNAP money and spending it at Walmart, instead you can spend it at a place where they have your best interest and the community's best interest in mind. So open to the public, deals with stigma, deals with choice, but also starts to deal with affordability.
Yeah, and so what I think these folks have done is put together a really comprehensive piece that studies this as a concept. But I actually got to know the two of them because we were at FoodLink, we were doing some research on this type of work because we've really kind of slowly entered the food retail world, specifically with our curbside market. But there's a lot of models out there. Right now, we were just talking, the four of us, about the model that's Open Table? Is that what Doug calls his store?
The Daily Table.
The Daily Table.
In Dorchester.
In Boston, the former head of Trader Joe started a kind of nonprofit grocery store. I went down with Julia Tedesco. We visited a place, Phil Abundance, the food bank in Philadelphia, started a store called Fair and Square Market. Baltimore Salvation Army just opened a store. And I'm sure they all run in different ways, but the ultimate point is that it's putting mission before profit. And it's allowing for an opportunity to leverage the existing dollars that people have in a community instead of trying to fill the gap of what they don't have. And this is happening a lot of different ways. It doesn't just have to be in food retail. In brick and mortar retail. With the curbside market, we were able to link up with the federal nutrition program, actually that Andy helped to advocate for, called FINNY, which essentially allows us to double people's SNAP dollars. So that's a really easy way of visualizing this. When someone gets $140 in SNAP and they spend that $140 with curbside on fruits, vegetables, and eggs, they get $280 worth of value. When they go spend that at Walmart, they get $140 worth of value. It's a simple way of us bringing in the mission for the profit.
Mm-hmm. Andy, this speaks to the concept in your book about food dignity.
Exactly. Thank you. I was just about to talk about that. You know, a lot of folks feel that if they're having to rely on a food pantry, it's inherently undignified. I've been in the position of doing that, and you're treated in a way of, you're pitied perhaps. You're not treated as a full customer with rights as you would be at a grocery store. So this concept of a social supermarket, you know, provides people with the ability to buy food at an affordable rate, but they're the same as anybody else. They're spending their own money to buy food, albeit it's a bit more affordable.
Mm-hmm. That's it. And I think, this is a great point to bring up. The idea behind social purpose grocery is, of course, to start chipping away at the issue of hunger, but it's also to then start chipping away at the other issues around our food assistance regime in general. And I think the issue of dignity is something that can be addressed particularly well. And it's not, it is, of course, these things like the stigma around attending a food bank. It's the availability in terms of opening hours and its location. But it's also things linked to the type of food you want to buy, as opposed to having to deal with what's in the hamper. You can go through the grocery store, make selections based on your preferences, based on your health. So people have a lot more choice. The dignity comes in the form of being a customer as opposed to a recipient.
Because just because you're poor, just because you don't have enough doesn't mean you have nothing. And when we treat people, when we define them by what they're lacking, they just become passive recipients of service. And that's like someone going to the doctor and saying, heal me, but I'm not going to take my medicine and I'm not going to do my exercises. No one ever was cured that way. People need to be active participants in their own well-being. They want to be. They're trying to be. And many aspects of our charitable system don't allow them to be. And this is a huge, huge, huge inhibition.
So, Megan, if you don't mind, I just want to add, I think that concept of dignity is a very important one to touch on. And I'll just give a reflection of the local community here for a second. I'd be remiss to not say that we have an incredible network of emergency food providers and folks who have really gone above and beyond to make sure that they do treat everyone with dignity. We have a lot of hot meal programs that will not serve without having a tablecloth and flowers on the table, making sure that people feel like they are really in a place that treats them as family and not as, you know, this kind of sterile version of patients. That being said, even those places, even the places that offer the most opportunities to really have a dignified experience would recognize that they don't have the infrastructure to be able to give people everything they need. Mm-hmm. which I think is the point here. Like, the folks have come a long way from the 1970s in the way they administer emergency food, but a lot of our food pantries don't have adequate refrigerators or freezers to be able to offer the right mix of food. They know that in recent months we've had a huge amount of new folks from Puerto Rico come to Rochester. They recognize they don't have culturally appropriate foods available to be able to provide those folks. And these are the best ones doing it. So clearly there's something that we need to do outside the Emergency Food Network without disparaging what they do.
Yeah. I know Andy wants to respond, yeah. Then we'll get to your phone calls. Listeners, hang there.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I just realized something as you're talking, Mitch. And it kind of goes back to the civil rights issues. You know, we've created this parallel system, this emergency food system for the poor. And it goes back to this whole concept of separate but equal. And we've created a separate food system for the poor through food pantries and the like. It is not equal, but isn't it better to have an integrated system, one system under which people can purchase other food as everybody else, as one, essentially, as without creating, again, a segregated system for the poor.
Mm-hmm. I think you're all talking about dignity and how choice is related to dignity. We did a program on the show about President Trump and the White House's plans or proposals to overhaul the SNAP program and integrate the concept of food boxes showing up at people's doors. Mitch was a guest on that program. You can listen to that. You can find it on our website. But that program not providing the kind of choice that our guests are talking about right now. So back to the phones we go. Up next is Deb in Rochester. Hi, Deb. Go ahead. Go ahead, Deb. All right, Deb, I'm going to put you back on hold. If you're still listening, hang there and try to get back to your phone. Let's head to Sarah in Rochester. Hi, Sarah, go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, great. My comments have to do with the wealth curve over the last 40 years or so. There's been this precipitous uptick in the amount of wealth that's going to a very small percentage of the population, particularly in the United States, but not only in the United States. And I'm wondering why it is that we're having such difficulty naming that as immoral, violent. I mean, it's creating the lack that is then leading to the need for us to be considering creative means of serving the needs of the poor. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Sarah. I'll let our guests jump in. Andy?
Sure. I mean, Sarah's absolutely right. The United States has the number one, is the worst wealth inequality of any country in the nation, of any country in the world, excuse me. And it is an insidious problem that has been documented to lead to many other social problems, including health inequities and inequities around domestic violence and the like. So it is an absolutely essential problem that those of us who work on anti-hunger issues, need to also we need to focus on not just poverty, but also income inequality and wealth inequality create many of the social problems that we deal with as a nation.
And while that gap is increasing, we're seeing that the level of kind of support and the safety net that's been provided by government is actually decreasing, which is in some ways the most insidious part of this, that as the Trump administration, I think, is doing everything they can to not minimize that wealth gap, they're actually trying to slash the safety net very explicitly. And the conversation we had a couple weeks ago about the harvest box, as they want to call it, isn't just about trying to optimize the food stamp program. It's trying to significantly slash the amount of dollars that the federal government spends on making sure people can eat. And it is the problem.
It's a great question, because I think it actually highlights for my colleague Daniel and I kind of our starting point. We recognize that there is an enormous amount of importance around advocacy work, around fundamental systems change to address these sorts of problems. However, we also recognize that today someone is hungry and tomorrow someone is hungry. And we need to come up with innovative ways to start chipping away at this problem. And I think this is where social purpose businesses can become, an interesting place to explore, whether it's food, whether it's affordable housing. If there is a way to intervene in the market, which is essentially producing this sort of inequality, and to intervene in a way that actually turns the heads, even to a greater extent, if possible, fundamentally, shifts what's possible in terms of intervening innovating in the market. You know, if charities can take a lead role in doing that, then we can start to talk about some really interesting examples of how we can actually address these more systemic underlying issues that are contributing to income inequality.
We're down to our last minute, and I'd like to end with a local look. So I'll turn to Andy, and I know that you're critical of, you know, certain food banks and the programs they run, but you are supportive of FoodLink and the work that they're doing. What most impressed you with what's going on here on the local level in Rochester?
A couple of things. I think, first of all, FoodLink thinks about their mission in terms beyond just moving food from point A to point B. They're not just about feeding the hungry. They engage in many other activities. We did a tour around the food bank earlier today, and they're, you know, one thing that impressed me very much is that they're buying apples from local farmers up here in New York State, processing them and distributing them to kids to eat at school. So it's a win-win-win program. I mean, it's benefiting local farmers. It's creating income for the schools. It's creating income for FoodLink, and it's providing just much healthier products for the kids as well.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, if you enjoyed this conversation and you'd like to hear more, there is a discussion today at FoodLink, or not at FoodLink, held by FoodLink at Three Heads Brewery on Atlantic Avenue from 4 to 6. It's a free event, but donations are encouraged. Correct, Mitch?
Yep, come on out. And I will say that getting to hear Andy talk about his book will be a real treat for everyone. One of the major reasons why we're able to do what we do at FoodLink is because of visionaries like Andy who've been talking about this stuff for the past two decades.
My thanks to Mitch Gruber from FoodLink and Rochester City Council. Thanks for being back on the program. My thanks to Daniel Bernhard and George Carruthers, our friends from the North, representing Mushroom Cloud in Toronto, and Andy Fisher, author of the book Big Hunger. You can hear more from him at Three Heads this afternoon. Also, my thanks to colleague Tiana Mannion, who's been helping us out on phones, Tim George, our engineer. I'm Megan Mack. We'll talk to you tomorrow.